the likes of yourself, elite runners, you're very lean and you're not a bodybuilder, you're not bulked up. So we don't need to be, I'd say, you need to focus less on hyper.
Not bulked yet.
That's it.
Wait until I'm back down the road, Jem. I'm coming in again.
Hello everybody and welcome to the Mountain Running Podcast. My name is Rob Sinclair and normally we would have the main man Seb Batchelor alongside me here, but in between work, life and training, things have been a bit mental for us both, to be honest. We've been working on some new podcast material, both together and separately. We've got some really cool new guests coming on the show in the next few weeks and we'll be back in the mix as a duo very soon to give your ears some more mountain chaos. So the topic for this episode, we decided it'd be good to focus on strength and conditioning, generally its application to the mountains and the active role it plays in keeping us injury-free to enjoy our running to its peak. It goes without saying that for many of us out there, this is something we will genuinely neglect and go out of our ways to do it. And everyone I speak to normally says, why would I be wasting my time doing this when I could be running around the hills? I think it's fair though to say to become a better runner, the principle of specificity does apply and you should be running more, but what about becoming a stronger runner for the mountains? We're asking our bodies to carry us up and down potentially thousands of metres in one outing. This could be during training or racing over tough terrain. It's rough, it's technical. Could be sky racing or battering ourselves in sort of the peat bogs over the hills and stuff. So your body's got to work hard, and if you're serious about your hills and training, you'll be battering yourself week in, week out, like myself and a lot of the other people we train with. So eventually your injuries and niggles will arise and we question why. And most of the time, the answer is pure and simple. You could definitely benefit from chucking some more strength and conditioning routines into your training program and spending a little bit more time rehabbing from injuries and focusing on really preventing those niggles from happening in the first place. So really, without getting torn up in a debate about biomechanics, the whole born to run or if you're made to run debate, I think it'd be a good time to have me stop rambling on here and pass you over to the main man, Sebby Boy. He had the pleasure of speaking to one of his go-to guys on board the Bachelor squad that goes by the name of Jem Yeselhurt. He is a sports and rehabilitation specialist and strength and conditioning coach that has played an essential part in supporting Seb throughout his 2019 season when he was able to compete at the top level internationally for GB over all of the mountain disciplines. You're really going to enjoy this, folks. This man is an absolute guru in his field of work and Seb is really intensely picking his brain, and I'll give you all a really good discussion to tune into.
Thanks very much for joining me on the pod, Jem. I know you're back and busy in the clinic and the gym, so really appreciate you taking the time to come on. How are things?
You're welcome. Oh, good, mate. How are you?
Yeah, not so bad. Looking forward to learning a bit more about some strength training, which is what we're going to concentrate on today, isn't it? So strength training for runners, and you're going to talk through some of the principles, which hopefully the listeners can then take away and put into practice themselves.
A strength training is just one of those things that I think is universally done across many sports, it offers extreme benefit. And I think sometimes we can get caught up in the sport itself and neglect things like strength training or, other modalities of training and just focus too much on the sport. And that, for me, limits our peak of performance. So it'd be good to talk about it.
Yeah, so what exactly would you say is strength training, and sort of where's it come from? Where's the sort of, would you say, is the origin of strength training?
Yeah, I think strength training for me, just, it doesn't have to be weights. It doesn't have to be, a fixed barbell or a dumbbell. It's just for me applying force to the system and then overcoming that resistance and therefore creating adaptation. I suppose the origin of sort of strength training can be dated as far back as, I believe it's the 6th century. There's a story the myth of Milo, if I get my reference correct there. It's just a small story that refers to what's called progressive overload. Progressive overload is a term of where we, as in its name, we increase load over time and therefore we gain strength adaptation. And the story goes far back where we've got Milo, this young wrestler in the 6th century, and he essentially carries a baby goat. You know, he carries it to a field every single day. Now, as that goat grows bigger, Milo gets stronger. And essentially, that is where, I suppose, in many terms, I know it's a small, anecdotal story, but I suppose that's where we get the idea of strength training. And the thing is with strength training, it isn't always that linear. You know, it will get to a point where that goat will be growing at a rate far quicker that you can gain strength adaptation. But the principle is the same. You know, we progressively overload resistance, and then in time, you know, we adapt accordingly. I think if we look at true strength training, and we'll talk about how this applies to runners as well, I think that for me at least, you know, if you've got, you know, the way the body adapts to strength training from a complete amateur to someone who's an experienced lifter, that varies a lot. You know, we often see like very high, what we call neurogenic changes, and neurogenic is just the nervous system getting a little bit more ramped up to a stimulus that it's never experienced before. So you often find, like, you know, with new lifters or new people who are new to resistance training, their strength in the first month, 6 weeks, just goes through the roof, you know what I mean? And that's, you know, that really gives people a big boost to get into strength training. But experienced lifters, they often find that, you know, a year into training, 2 years into training, you know, they're not hitting those gains. You know, they may be even lucky to hit a 5 kilo increase in, you know, 6 weeks, for example, you know what I mean? But as an amateur lifter, somebody's never done it before, they may be going 20 kilo, 30 kilo in the space of 6 weeks. So yeah.
But that's sort of the same in almost any kind of training, isn't it? To start with, you're starting at a lower level, it's easier to make those increases or incremental increases, and then the better you get at something, the harder it is to improve and the harder it is to make those make those gains in whatever area that is. So you're thinking, like, initially it's more like a neurological adaption, and then what do we need to be triggering as we become more experienced then in order to make those adaptions? Or is that something that you need to refine? How do you do that? So someone that, say, a runner out there that's been gymming for, I don't know, 5-6 years, and they kind of stagnated in it, what would they need to do differently?
Yeah, that's a good question, really. I think for me, looking at training, especially strength training and any form of training, is like a pyramid. So the better your foundation, the higher the peak of performance. And that for me goes to everything, you know, whether it's learning a new skill, whether it's running, whether it's strength training. I think if we can get the foundations right early on, so if we start off and we go, right, can, you know, what's the athlete's movement literacy like when it comes to strength training? Have they got a decent squat, a deadlift? Can they hip hinge? Can they do things on two legs basically really well? And then the more experienced lifter, they may be doing things, you know, on a single leg. They may be incorporating more dynamic tasks. They may be doing things like plyometrics, speed work, looking at how quick they can move the bar. It's quite an interesting one, strength training, because for me, I think it gets a bit, you know, there's a misconception that, you know, you're stronger the heavier you lift. And for me, you know, we need to look at also, well, what, you know, there's a direct correlation between not only lifting a weight, you know, slow and heavy, but also what about fast and a bit lighter, because the net force is probably going to be the same thing. So we don't always need to lift heavy, you know what I mean? But yeah, going back to your point, you know, the experienced lifter, they may be, or the experienced, you know, gym goer, they may start to venture into single leg work, you know, Bulgarian split squats, single leg squats, pistol squats, and all this sort of stuff. So yeah.
And I guess also the same as any sort of training as well, the body adapts to doing like a certain exercise or a certain session. So sometimes, I guess, just mixing it up or coming in with some new exercises, like going to see someone like yourself that's going to come at it at a different angle, that could be the difference in order to go from stagnation to getting that graph or that curve on the upward slope again.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think a lot of people, they do stagnate in their training, especially, you know, they can get into a bit of a rut with, you know, training twice a week in the gym, and they can have their structure of, you know, 2-3 runs a week, and that might be them. And like you said, they stagnate, they can't get past a certain, say, 10K time, for example, or they can't get past a certain level of resistance. And yeah, absolutely. I think it takes, you know, a second set of eyes to sort of look at the way we move. I think, you know, runners aren't bodybuilders. You don't train muscle groups, you train movements. And that's a really important concept that people need to, I feel like, learn. And they need to spend more time assessing the quality of movement rather than the weight that they're lifting. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so that's actually a really interesting point. So what do you mean by training a movement rather than a muscle group? Like, how would you explain that exactly? Because that's a good, very good point.
Yeah, so I think when we look at training a movement and not a muscle, we look at the type of lift that we're doing. So an isolation-based exercise is where you'd be training a muscle group. So your typical, your bicep curl, your seated knee extension. They're not that they're bad, everything has its place, but for an athlete, in my opinion, their foundation, going back to the foundation that makes the biggest difference, what's your bang for your buck? It's training compound movements. When we talk about compound, the word compound in the sort of the S&C world, if you like, is referring to a multi-joint movement. So something that is involved in maybe hip, knee and ankle at the same time. So that's your thing, like a squat, a lunge, you know, an RDL. They're going to be more bang for your buck exercises. And therefore, in my opinion at least, they're going to have more transfer over to things like running or a sport. But that's not to say the accessory movements. Like, you might have someone, you know, who's got an injury, so, you know, they might have, you know, knee pain, for example, and you might say, get your quad stronger, you know, and a good way to do that is an isolation exercise. So everything has its place, but your foundation movements and your foundation training, I think, should come from more compound lifts.
Just stepping back a little bit to what you said before. So someone starting out is going to have some, you know, sort of more neurological adaption where you're getting those nerve impulses firing a little bit more. So with strength training, what are the physiological adaptions that are actually occurring? So by doing these compound movements, like, apart from perhaps becoming more body aware, like, what's actually happening in the body, if you can kind of explain that in like fairly layman's terms?
Yeah, so for me, ultimately, you've got your brain, you've got nerve endings that go towards the muscle. That connection between the brain and the muscle and the time it takes for that stimulus to sort of go to the muscle and back up to the brain to perform movement is essentially a muscle contraction, okay? So with muscles and muscle groups, rather, that we don't typically use, so going back to that amateur or even, like, you know, someone who's never been to the gym before, that pathway, A, isn't very well established, and B, just, you know, the capacity to which it's needed isn't very high. You know, for someone who maybe sits in an office most days and doesn't really call upon their body to use that pathway much, it just isn't there. So the initial adaptation is, you know, getting the brain to understand that there's a signal that needs to happen, there's a time in which that needs to happen, or a rate in which it needs to happen. So the initial changes, and also changes that happen to elite athletes as well, is but more so for the amateurs, is neurogenic. So in our muscles, the connection between a nerve and a muscle unit on a, you know, a very sort of microscopic level would be called a motor unit. Now, in that, so say if we have a muscle that has 100 motor units, initially, day to day, we may call upon, say, 20 motor units, but someone who's actively doing strength training, they need more to overcome the resistance. So therefore, you know, the adaptation will be, we get used to using more motor units. Now, the different longer term is hypertrophy. So that actual muscle, not only using more motor units, but actually growing in size. So that's when we break a muscle down, it grows back and we actually create more motor units. So instead of 100, we may have 110 or 120. The actual number is irrelevant. It'll be loads more than that. But the principle is that that's more like a longer term adaptation, that actual, you know, motor units actually developing, new muscle fibers developing. That's a much longer process. And they're the two main probably changes.
During those kind of longer term changes where you're seeing an increase in the number of motor units, by that, I think, if I can remember correctly, back to my studying a few years ago, is the sarcomere, I think, is the contractile unit of muscle, skeletal muscle. Yeah. So are you seeing a sort of increase, not only sort of cell size, so hypertrophy, within strength training, are we also seeing a degree of hyperplasia, so a sort of increase in fiber numbers, or is that to a lesser degree?
Yeah, you'll see, like I said, you'll see, you know, if we're developing new muscle tissue, you're going to see more sarcomeres, do you know what I mean? And more, you know, on a very, very cellular level, the actin and myosin fibers binding together. So you're just getting more of that.
Oh, yeah. Got to try and remember all that. Yeah. the ratchet mechanism and all that stuff.
There we go. So we just get a lot more of that going on. And, I always say with something like this, you know, the physiology is, you know, I suppose, important when you study it, but the actual practicality of it is more, you know, how much do we need? You know, they'll get to a point of diminishing returns, do you know what I mean? They'll get a point of, you only need to be so strong to be a good runner. You'll only need to be so, you know, we're not bodybuilders, we're not powerlifters if you're running. You just need to be to a level of strength. So you don't need, you know, it's an interesting one. You look at, the likes of yourself, elite runners, you're very lean and you're not a bodybuilder, you're not bulked up. So we don't need to be, you know, I'd say, you know, you need to focus less on hyper.
Not bulked yet.
And that's it.
Wait until I'm back down the road, Jem. I'm coming in again.
the point, you know, of, you know, you just need to be strong to a point. That's it, really.
So you touched on it a little bit before on kind of what you called your bang for buck exercises. So what, going a little bit further into that, what strength training exercises should we kind of all be doing as runners, and specifically as mountain runners? So we're spending a lot of time running uphill and downhill for a long period of time. I guess it's activating the different muscle groups, isn't it?
Sure. No, it's a really good question. I think I've got to be careful in saying that, you know, not everyone should be doing the same thing. And I think that's really important. We're all different. We're all really in a situation where, you know, some people may have, you know, really limited ankle range and they just don't like squatting. So they may prefer deadlifting because that might be an easy way to move a resistance, you know. But generally speaking, if we're climbing up hills, mountain running, like you said, you know, things like working from a deficit works quite well. So, you know, like a lunge, but your front leg is on something that's higher, so you have to drop lower. You're asking more of your glutes in an outer range position. Equally, downhill may be fairly quad dominant. So, you know, you need to be in a situation where you can decelerate well for your quads. And I think, you know, you're looking at two phases there. The upwards phase is a concentric, or predominantly a concentric movement. And I think we were going to talk about this at some point, is that, you know, when we look at a muscle contraction, there's three phases typically. We've got the concentric, is where the muscle shortens and is producing force. We have the isometric phase, where the muscle is producing force, but it's not changing shape, it's just holding its position. And then we have the eccentric phase, which is where the muscle is lengthening and it's decelerating at the same time. So it's almost like, you know, slowing down the movement. So upwards, if we're focusing, you know, if we look at a runner and we're creating needs analysis for that runner, we say, like, what does that runner really need to improve on? And it was the concentric, you know, the upward phase of running, then we might focus a little bit more on concentric. And if we look at, okay, the downhill, sort of scrambling downhill, or, you know, run downhill, that's harder for the athlete, we might focus on, you know, doing a little bit more deceleration, eccentric work to that person. I think as soon as you go from, you know, middle to, you know, when the leg goes behind you, it's very eccentric at that point. Your rear leg's decelerating, the front leg's. It's interesting, really, with running. It's because it's a really confusing area of, like, when strength training of, you know, where do you start? Do you know what I mean? Because a lot of people who run and are very good runners, you know, you get quite a lot of people, fair play, who have incorporated strength training off their own back, they've done their own research, but someone just brand new into it, they don't know where to start. And they always start, if rather than breaking strength exercises down into machines or movement of, you know, squat, we've got deadlift, we've got lunges, we've got hip thrust, we've got, you know, it's so confusing, they don't know where to start. What is the primary movement of running is typically a pushing movement. We are pushing the floor away from us, and that reaction force propels the body forward. So focusing, for me at least, on the most part, on, like, pushing based exercises where possible is really good. So hip thrusters, lunges, squatting, You know, obviously there's going to be a deceleration phase and some pulling forces on the body for that, but pushing movements initially on two legs is a great start. And then when you get, you know, confident and you're, you know, becoming more experienced, pushing movements on one leg is really good as well.
And what do you mean by out of range? So does that mean you, like you say, you're going like a high step up, or
yeah, really?
Like what do you exactly mean? But do you mean by out of range movement?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think when we look at it, when we talk about out of range, it's firstly, you know, it's when muscles are under stretch. So if we look at something like running, for me, running speed is determined by stride length and stride frequency. So the longer you can step and the quicker you can make that step or stride, the quicker that you'll be. So for me, it's like, you know, when doing an exercise like a lunge, outer range is like how far is the front leg from the rear leg. You know, that's an outer range position. Equally out of range, maybe, or how low are you squatting, or an out of range, you know, so not working a muscle in the small ranges, either via the joint range or the muscle stretch.
Okay, so just going back onto the sort of original question on what, not everyone, but just as a generalized overview, you know, for sort of uphill, we're looking at kind of the outer range movement, whether you're doing a sort of a split squat with a raised leg,
yeah,
or, you know, something like that. Or I like a high box step up,
yeah.
Because when we're racing in the mountains and it's very steep, you're almost doing like, you feel like you're just doing massive high box step ups for 40 minutes or something.
Yeah.
And then for sort of the downhills, I know personally, it's sort of all VMO. You know, my VMOs just get absolutely smashed. So, like, do you think you can? Because a question that people actually often ask me is, because a lot of the time I'm based down near you, and it's pan flat, isn't it? And it's like, how can I maintain a degree of conditioning when I'm on the flat the most of the time, yet I want to race in the hills? And I think you can do that in the gym to a degree, can you not?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you know, you're absolutely right. You can do things that it's an interesting one, really, because you've got the, you know, being strong to do it, so that's important, but it can you do it repeatedly? And I think that's a different question, because it's how well can you do it when your body is flooded with lactic acid, or how well can you do it when, you know, you're in scenarios where your energy systems aren't, you know, quite you know, well adapted. So that's where I suppose conditioning strength comes in. So things like, you know, hip training is really good for that sort of stuff, where you can get an exercise that you might do, you know, a blast on the assault bike, and you might fry your quads a little bit, and then you go straight into something like a step up, you know, or box step ups. So your quads or your VMOs, like you said, are in a situation where, you know, they are fatigued, but they still got to perform. So that's a nice conditioning piece, if you like.
I like that. Yeah, I like that one. I've never actually gone off the back of a very hard, say something like explosive on the bike, if you go on the turbo or something, and then jumped off and gone in the gym. I've never done that. So that's an interesting idea, actually.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it's there's loads of, like, in strength training or any training, there's loads of ways to achieve a goal, and a lot of times there's no like right way, but there's just different ways that works for different people. And I think, you know, for me, you know, when talking about strength training, I'd, you know, certainly get someone like yourself to do that, but someone who's not well experienced, that's just not the right thing to do. Do you know what I mean? It's not the right idea to go and, you know, blast their body and do something that, you know, that is high level, because they're just going to injure themselves, so, you know, or be at risk of that. And that's going back to that pyramid. People build pyramids upside down. They start with it's like nutrition. Do you know what I mean? If people take supplements, or not everyone, some people may take supplements before getting their diet in check. No, we need to get the diet right, and then we take supplements to supplement the diet. These are like supplementary exercise. Conditioning is supplementing what you're already doing really well, like the squats, the lunges, the deadlifts, etc. I feel.
Yeah, no, I love the pyramid analogy as well, because I use that, because I see, you know, it's funny when you said, yeah, you've got to have a big base in order to have a high peak. And I say that, like, I genuinely say that all the time. It's like, that's why the importance of like aerobic base training is, 100%. If you haven't got that large base, then your peak can only be so high, whereas if you've got the wider your base, the higher your peak.
I couldn't agree more.
I think that, yeah, so talking on sort of coming off, segueing off aerobic base training, like, how can sort of strength training help our kind of aerobic sort of fitness? Is there a part to play in it?
I think so. I suppose I might be a little bit biased on that one, but I definitely think there's a part to play in it. I think when we look at strength training, when we look at running, so running's the skill, running's the sport, if you like. And at the end of the day, we have what we call like a running economy. So what is our heart rate response to running? Okay, now obviously there'll be certain thresholds, you know, easy runs might not take too much off our body, but certainly when we're under situations like, you know, competition or somewhere we're asking more from our body, strength training can really sort of offset the aerobic demand. And what I mean by that is, if you look at running economy, if when we're running and we're fatigued and, you know, our knees are collapsing inwards, we're not maintaining posture, we're using, you know, from our aerobic system in many ways, energy to keep our body upright. Now, if we have a really good underlying level of strength, then our heart rate isn't going to need to do that. It's going to be able to just focus on the task, which is getting one leg in front of the other, getting running, and not having to worry about, you know, deficits in our core, our glutes, our posture, you know, and we often call that running, energy leaks. So, you know, when we run, where are the leaks coming from? Where's the energy? You know, because we want our energy to be directed in a straight line. We're going forwards. So any leaks that are going inwards to the center of the body, lateral displacement, too much vertical bounce, you know, these are leaks. These aren't going to get us, you know, from A to B in the quickest time. They're going to sort of build in a little bit of a squiggly line towards B. So strength training, in my opinion, controls those energy leaks if done correctly. And therefore, our aerobic system can just focus on the task, which is just performing the physiological sort of, you know, the Krebs cycle, like the getting rid of the CO2, putting oxygen into the muscle, and repeating that cycle.
Yeah, going back to the old studying again. No, that's don't please. I'm on holiday. At the moment. But no, it's taking like all those. All those little things, whether it's reducing vertical oscillation when we're running, any, like as you say, lateral movement that's deviating from, you know, propelling ourselves in a straight line. And I guess you've probably seen, you know, you can correct those what seem fairly minor minor issues, if you want to call it that, within running form, and actually the performance benefits from correcting those can be quite large.
Well, I think that's the thing, because, you know, they can be quite minor, but multiply that by, you know, thousands of steps, it becomes a big problem. And that's the key thing, really. It's like, you know, someone poking you in the head once isn't a big deal, but get them to do it for 3 hours, I'm sure it'll get quite annoying. You know what I mean? So that's the sort of the idea with these energy leaks. Can we just get as close to optimal as possible? And I feel like a lot of people would be better for it.
Yeah. And when, again, without wanting to generalize too much, but I guess we have to a degree,
yeah.
You sort of recommending, because there's a couple of different ways of looking at strength training with what you're actually doing when it comes down to sets and reps. Are you kind of an advocate for volume with sort of lighter weight, or are you thinking kind of, right, rack it up, 3 reps?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, again, to answer that question, we need to, and again, there's no one right way, but we need to sort of let's take the individual into consideration. You know, if you've got a very new beginner, you know, I would never put them under a high loaded situation, especially with because lifting's a skill, especially doing squats and all that sort of stuff. So I'd always start with high volume, and I think you get like a high neurogenic benefit from that. So going back to the whole motor units getting activated, volume is really good for that. And also, when you consider someone who's new to it, you know, their focus is running and getting better at running. So anything you do to the system, you don't want to do to offset their training. So you get someone who's not done much lifting before, you get them to lift, they're going to be sore. They just will be, because you're going to get that delayed onset of muscle soreness. So I think the primary focus is making sure that happens as little as possible, so the runner can focus on running and the strength training is doing its job by supplementing the running. I don't think it's a good strength training program if you've got a runner who wants to strength train and they can't run for 6 weeks because they're getting used to, you know, high loads. I don't think that's a good strategy at all. There's a really good sort of going back to sort of, you know, let's take now the more experienced lifter in, who is a runner into this situation. I've been doing a bit of reading and I sort of came across this. I was actually listening to a Joe Rogan podcast, believe it or not. And it's,
You got me onto Joe Rogan originally as well.
They're really good. And there's this trainer here, I think his name is Barossa Harvey, and he trains MMA fighters. And one of the things he says is he approaches more of like a volume approach. So in the way he puts it into context, although it's not as simple as this in the real world, is that, so say if you've got someone who can do pull-ups, right? So their maximum is 10 pull-ups. They can't do any more. If they had a gun to their head, they just couldn't do 11. 10 is maximum. So their 10 of pull-ups is the same as someone's RPE, so their rate of perceived exertion being a 10. They match up really well. If you ever do an 8, 9, or a 10 training session, and you'll know this yourself, it's pretty hard to ask it an 8, 9, 10 the next day. It's just your body is fatigued, both physiologically and even psychologically. So you may have in your week 3, potentially 4, but let's say 3 because we need a day off in between each one, 3 8 out of 10 sessions or 3 9 out of 10. So if you take that into the context of a pull-up, you know, say someone does like 9 pull-ups, they might have, you know, 9, 18, 27 pull-ups at the end of their week, okay? So, but you get someone to train at, you know, more 5 out of 10, you know? So they train 5 pull-ups. They can train every day because they're not experiencing this soreness. So by the end of their week, if they've trained 5 pull-ups every single day, their net volume is going to be higher. Do you know what I mean? And they've therefore had, you know, every week, you multiply that over 52 weeks, their overall volume is going to be higher. And their 5 pull-ups soon becomes 6. But they're still working at a 5 out of 10. You see my point? So they're still experiencing progressive overload in the same way the other person is experiencing progressive overload. But sometimes we can maybe see that this 5 out of 10 over a year might actually get stronger. It's not the same for everyone, but it is an argument, and it is something that isn't going to disrupt your running as much as someone who's doing an 8 or a 9 or a 10 out of 10 session.
So just to explain further, what do you mean by progressive overload?
Progressive overload for me is that idea that we are over time increasing the load towards the body. So, you know, over 6 weeks, 12 weeks, whatever it is, we might have someone who starts their squats on, you know, 50 kilo. By the end of 6 weeks or 12 weeks, they may progress to 70 kilo, you know, whatever it might be. And that to me is progressive overload. They're able to achieve the same number of repetitions with a higher load, which they couldn't do previously.
Okay. And does that tie into the term super compensation? Is that got a part to play within that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing with super compensation is that when we do it, we do an exercise, we put the body through resistance. When we break it down, essentially, the body fatigues, and we need a period of time of rest and recovery.
So like that day almost, you were saying, or it could be longer than that, depending on how fatigued you are.
Yeah, I'd actually say like with the super compensation theory is that you have like maybe potentially a week of in the powerlifting world, or they call it like a deload week. So you might be working and pushing your body for 4 to 6 weeks, pretty high level. Then you have a week of deload where you reduce the weight quite significantly, so you allow the body to rest. You may restart that cycle of lifting again. And then we have this big boost in the body sort of physiological system, and we get a boost in strength. We always need a rest period. I think, you know, there's this mentality, and it can be quite high, I see in runners especially, of like, you know, no days off, you know. When someone's asleep, I'm running, and, you know, like you want to get ahead, you want to be better than the next person. But actually, you know, and I understand that from a psychological point of view, but actually the body needs rest. It needs rest to adapt. A really good thing that I listened to it at UTS, where I take a lot of the patients from the clinic into the gym, there's a Dr. Bacall, he works there, and he talks about this term when we look at exercise as a stimulus. and then how we then create an environment for the body to adapt to that stimulus. So if we look at an hour of exercise, that's technically 4% of our day. The remaining 23 hours that we have of that day, you know, is how can we emphasize that 4% of stimulus? So if we get good sleep, good nutrition, you know, health, you know, like some healthy eating, you know, we're not stressed, we're, you know, we're having good job satisfaction, or we're just, you know, we're generally in a good headspace, that stimulus will have a higher effect. But if we do a, you know, a really hard session and then we, you know, we have a bad diet, we have really high sugary foods, we don't, you know, we're not getting good sleep, we're watching telly, playing PlayStation, whatever it is, it's not a good environment for our exercise to, you know, take effect.
No, that's very interesting. And on that vein, would you say like strength training has a part to play in recovery? Because I've done a little bit of research for, you know, my own interest, on this is kind of going sort of the opposite way to kind of what you're advocating doing. But if we lift very heavy weights but low reps, say the afternoon after running a session, a hard session, the body's then going to be triggered into releasing like testosterone and HGH.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, testosterone is involved in, is required for the release of insulin-like growth factor 1, which is then part of, you know, muscle recovery.
Sure.
Or, you know, it helps regeneration, basically. Is that something we should really be thinking about? Or is that kind of just a bonus? Like, because I've thought, for my own training, should I be thinking about positioning a few hard, like sort of heavyweight gym sessions after hard running sessions or in the afternoon? Like, what's your take on that?
That's a really good question, because there's definitely been research around like squatting and compound movements, and like you said, release of, you know, human growth hormone and testosterone with the body, and for sure that does aid with recovery. It's a really interesting question, actually, and I don't think personally I'd recommend that for definitely not a novice. You know, like I said, an elite athlete like yourself, it's a part of the puzzle. It's something to think about. But you know, in terms of my the logic in me, I'd sort of say I wouldn't necessarily do that after a hard session. As such, I think there's other ways to recover more optimally. I think the body would recover well through really good quality sleep. The only reason I say that as well is because, you know, and you can also get things, you know, if we're looking at it from like, how do we define recovery? Are we looking at it from a hormonal change within our body, or are we looking at how do we feel the next day? If we're looking at how we feel the next day, then, you know, something more to the effect of an ice bath, because ice baths and cryotherapy have been shown to release the same hormones, you know, human growth hormone and potentially testosterone as well. So that could be a factor. We could look at, you know, really good quality of sleep to allow, you know, when our heart rate dips really well, you know, that's when the magic happens in recovery a lot of the time. So that's another factor. But yeah, for lifting, you know, heavy weights as such, I don't know if that's a safe way to do it, especially if it's a skill-based movement like a squat. If you were to do that approach, maybe something like a leg press or something which requires high force but low movement competency would be a better alternative. But one thing I would say on recovery strategies is that the more you, and I say this universally across everything really, is that the more you use a recovery strategy, the less potent it becomes. So you might use like a complex unit, or you might have an ice bath, or you might have a deep tissue massage. You do that every day or every time you have a hard session, the less effect that will have on the body, because like resistance training, the body adapts, you know, it will adapt to anything that you give it. The same thing with foam rolling. The amount of times I'm sure you've used the foam roller, sometimes
I don't think it does anything anymore.
Exactly. So
genuinely,
yeah.
So I've been using it for like 12 years now. I've been foam rolling, and I don't think it does anything.
Yeah, and you're probably one of those, you know, really good, really well structured, really well disciplined, and many people are, you know, in the people who get to the level that you're at, they use these recovery strategies a lot because they want to train harder and more often. And you know, I always say to you, like, sometimes let the body do what it needs to do, because you can't beat biology, it'll do its thing. But if you, you know, if you use something too often, you use those recovery strategies, they lose effect, in my opinion. Universally, the body will just adapt to it really quick. It's funny, like, I used a Theragun, not long ago. And
any good?
Yeah, they're decent. And other percussive tools are available.
Devices are on the market. I'm not endorsed by Theragun.
I wish
yet,
it was.
Again.
Yeah, I wish it was there. They're expensive bits of kit, but I use one. I've never really used them, to be fair. And the DOMS that I had from it the next day in the one place, I only used it on my VMO, and the next day I was like, wow, that's like, it's done something, because, you know, I had this like, you know, it felt loose, do you know what I mean? But it felt like I had, you know, done something on the area. But then if, you know, the people that have used them in the past, you know, they might use them every day and be like, oh, I don't think this does anything anymore. And, you know, but that's the neurogenic, you know, adaptation that we experience with anything.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of discussion on that around caffeine and when it comes to fueling. You know, if you sort of stave off caffeine for a few weeks in the build up to an important race, and has a greater effect. But that's another discussion. Just quickly before we move on, just jumping back to what you said on utilizing perhaps like a leg press. Yeah. Like when would you say, right, we're going to isolate on a leg press or a calf raise machine as opposed to getting in the squat rack? Because without, say, wanting to go into details on all my bucket up problems, we did an awful lot on the calf raise machine and the leg press machine in order to really, really weight things up. Like, is that the main benefit, or when does each have its part to play within strength training?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think, you know, if you look at, so for me, we want to gain, for example, posterior chain strength. So, you know, glutes, hamstrings, calves, for example, really getting that fired up. If someone's just super quad dominant on a squat, so, you know, they're just really, you know, avoidant of using their glutes, for example, you know, you wanted to get them to isolate that a bit more, because that's where they're, you know, having a bit of a deficit, you know, then you might turn to a leg press. Equally, if somebody's injured or you want to create a stable environment for them to lift in, then a leg press is really, really good because it is stable. You just focus on the weight going up and down in a very linear fashion. You know, and equally also, if you've got someone who's new to the gym and they want to get a bit of resistance into the body, then leg press is fantastic. Like I said, the squat is a skillful movement, and there's a reason, you know, the reason why it's in the Olympics, you know what I mean? It's the reason why we have movements like clean and jerk, you know, snatches, the skillful movements. And, you know, when we look at, if you analyze like the bar path, so when someone squats up and down, the bar doesn't travel in a straight line, it sometimes dips and curves a bit. That variability in the curve of the bar when it's going up and down will massively vary. You know, if you've got someone who's an elite lifter, it'll do the same sort of movement within a few degrees of change. But if you've got someone who's like novice, that bar path is constantly changed. Every time that bar path changes, that's different leverage on different joints. You know that if you're doing a leg press, pretty much it's going to be the same force throughout the same movement. If you cut and providing your knees aren't doing some funky stuff, if they're pretty much sitting in the same line, you'll be emitting the same force through the joint. So, I reckon new lifter, someone who wants to, you know, isolate a certain part of the body, they're probably the best. You know, best suited to a leg press, and or an elite lifter, like you said, he wants to mix it up a little bit more with their training, or just they've hit a bit of a plateau.
And moving on to plyometrics, because plyometrics are sort of becoming quite popular, aren't they? So there's quite a lot of buzz around them, and there's always people pushing plyometric boxes, and some people are probably like, what on earth is a plyometric box? And so what exactly is plyometric training, and sort of where does it have its place?
Yeah, so that's another great question. I think that plyometric training is just looking at the stretch shortening of a muscle, of a tendon, so for me, you know, somebody, you know, I see people sometimes saying they're doing plyometric training and they're just doing box jumps, so they'll stand on the floor and then they'll do a static jump. A true plyometric, you know, jump, if you like, is where you maybe step on one box, you jump, you land, and you jump again. Do you know what I mean? So it's that sort of, that you call like a counter jump. And what that's doing is it's increasing tendon stiffness. So basically making sure that tendon can collect energy and release energy really, really quickly. Think of it like a spring. If you've got an old spring that's really slack, if you squeeze it, it's not going to bounce. But if you've got a very high taut spring and you squeeze it, you put force through it and let go, it's going to spring really well. It's a very interesting area, and when looking at the need for it, I think there is a need for it to be in your training program. I think that general strength training is probably more important for runners like yourself, but supplementing a little bit of plyometric in there, because you may need to bound up and down uneven terrain or bigger steps, but for someone like a sprinter or someone who's a bit more explosive, that's when they need the more plyometrics. Do you know what I mean? But end of the day, plyometrics, it's high, it's low weight, but it's high speed, therefore high force. So if you've got someone who's not a great lifter or they haven't got gym access, plyometrics are a good way of getting stronger too, because ultimately you're putting high force through the body. But like I said, it's not all about a load. It's definitely about a force rather,
Yeah. And because you're talking, talking quite a lot there about tendons and their role within the movement. So is sort of a dynamic plyometric exercise going to help the kind of structure and the health of the tendon? Because I mean, you know, my history and my Achilles tendons are absolutely shredded, like not in a good way. So is that something, say someone like me that's got issues around tendons, but and it's got to a point where they've kind of progressed past your heavy loading or your rehab exercises, is that something that they could do potentially more frequently in order to load the Achilles in a controlled manner and build the stability around that, or does it not work that way?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think that everything has its place. Typically for an injury, I'd always say, see where you're at, see where you're at in the recovery process, and they'll be able to sort of implement that phase of conditioning and training into your program. However, generally speaking, it's certainly a good thing for tendon health, I feel, especially if you're to run, you need elasticity of your tendon. So plyometrics are a way of doing that, but there's a level of, there's an entry level requirement of, are you at that level yet? And, can you do that before doing like a max box jump for height? Can you hop pain free? Can you hop pretty well? Can you skip? Can you run pretty pain free? If someone's doing a 1 mile run and their Achilles is on fire, it's not a good idea to do, it's not a good idea to do repeated box jumps, because the two outweigh each other too much. Do you know what I mean? So everything often has its place and offers benefit.
Yeah. So how using that and moving on, kind of like, how would you then structure a strength training session? How someone that isn't gonna, say, come and see you in order to have the program written for them, are they able to go away and structure a bit of a plan themselves? Like, what would you kind of the basis of that?
I certainly think generally speaking, you should always do your power movements first and then later on go into your strength based movements, because power requires speed of contraction, so rate of force development. However, the strength can be more of a slow movement. So if you do strength, you can't really do your power. But if you do your power first, you're probably going to be able to still crack on with your strength. Before every session, I consider what movements are involved. So as part of a warm-up, isn't necessarily about just getting your heart rate up and getting a bit of sweat on. It's about activating the right muscles. And, I've done quite a bit of work with, various sports teams. And one of the things I try and teach, especially from, people who are young, they're learning about training, I sort of say, right, activation is key. Can you switch glutes on? Have you got a good awareness of, contracting your glutes? I'm not saying squeezing your glutes, I'm saying, can you, produce a movement like hip extension and feel it using your glutes rather than your lower back or your hamstrings? and then go into something like a squat, and then go into something like, you know, a lunge. And, you know, because a lot of people, that they, the body, like anything, takes the path of least resistance. It will do things in the easiest way it knows how, and, you know, sometimes that's not always the right way.
Yeah, so let's just pick up on, because then a couple of terms that you've sort of, you know, thrown around with me is kind of like global strength and unilateral work, and how that falls into kind of your training strength structure, like training sessions. Like what do you mean by those terms?
So global strength is just being, you know, general for me, you know, how robust is the athlete, how robust is the individual. Globally being strong, I'd be looking at movements, you know, like the squat, deadlifts, lunging, how, you know, how globally, you know, strong is that individual. And then you can look at more specifics of unilateral work, where you've got somebody who, you know, can perform a single leg squat or a single leg pistol squat pretty well on both sides. Do you know what I mean? And that's where the energy leaps can really be highlighted. If you've got someone who's, you know, doing a single leg or unilateral based exercise, and they perform a single leg squat, they can do it in two different ways completely. Not necessarily one way is right or wrong, but, you know, I always say a good way to identify if a, you know, a movement is optimal is the effort it takes. So, you know, if you get someone to do a lunge and they're grimacing and they're, you know, pulling all these funny faces on the right leg, but on the left leg it just looks easy. You know there's probably something going on that right side that you need to address. Although you've completed the movement with the same resistance, doesn't mean it's optimal.
Really, really interesting stuff. And how often would you say you should be doing strength training sessions and incorporating that into your general running plan?
Again, I suppose it depends on, you know, where you're at in terms of your current season of running. You know, are you taking a bit of a break where you can focus on your strength more? Or are you in a situation where you're, your maintenance? In maintenance, I'd sort of say 1 to 2 sessions a week of strength is pretty decent. Outside of that, you may be ramping up to 3 sessions if you're a bit quieter with your running. Even 1 session is enough stimulus to the body to get gains, you know, and just to allow optimal strength. Because strength is important. Really important for injury prevention. Just being robust is so key, preventing injuries and optimizing performance.
And without wanting to go into too much detail, you know, you mentioned there about, you know, sometimes you could have 1 session a week, and another time you could have a couple of sessions a week, or maybe you've got a little, you know, period of time where you could even build in 3 sessions a week. So I mean, I do talk about, you know, periodizing your training, and you definitely, I think, have to periodize your gym training or your strength training as well, don't you? Because you can't just do the same thing all year round and expect to elicit the same improvements.
Yeah, for sure. I think that, you know, falls under, you know, it depends in you know, what sport you're in and when you compete in. If you've got an event, you know, that's your target, you want to peak at that event, so therefore you might have a general preparatory phase, and then that might lead into more. So you might generally, when you start with squats and deadlifts and, you know, big compound movements, and then later on, as you get closer to that, you know, sport specific phase, you might add in more unilateral work on a single leg, you know, incorporating more sport specific movement drills that are more functional to your sport, like running. So you might be doing things in a split stance or running, or adding a little bit more strength with rotation, because we have rotation in our running. And then, you know, so to the point where your competition happens and you're at your peak. So it's all relative to where, you know, where you're at in your periodized cycle. And it's all relative to, you know, if you compete all year round or you train for one event. But you're absolutely right. You know, I think, you know, we need to ensure that we work backwards from a specific goal, and, you know, that's where we want to be at our best. So what then comes before that? You know what I mean?
Exactly. No, that's absolutely fascinating. And I'd say personally, I think if starting out, that it'd be a good idea to see someone like yourself, or even better still, just see you, and get you going, you know, in the right direction. Because I think form is so important, and doing the exercise correctly. Like I used to think I had, you know, pretty good gym form, and then, you know, I saw you and you just picked up on a few things, whether it was like getting that, you know, anterior pelvic tilt in my squat and engaging the glutes. And so, you know, you can think you have very good form and you're doing an exercise correctly, but actually having a set of eyes such as yourself looking over really can make an awful lot of difference.
100%. And I often think that, you know, when we're in the gym, you know, when I'm in the gym and, you know, I'm so focused on, you know, moving the resistance from A to B, that sometimes I don't notice the sort of things that are going on. And like I said, you know, there's always going to be someone else who's going to have, you know, some other ideas that are going to take you hopefully to that next level. And it's just like I said, a second set of eyes, or even, you know, just recording yourself in the gym, and reviewing that back. Do you know what I mean? Reviewing yourself at home doing a certain movement, and you'll be like, oh my God, I can't believe that, you know, I do this movement like that, when it just fits. Because what good feels like doesn't mean it's good or optimal. You know what I mean? Sometimes, you know, what comfortable feels like is just what your body prefers at that time. Doesn't mean it can't be better.
I find all this kind of discussion absolutely fascinating. It's and it's really good to get you on and talk about your wealth of knowledge.
I don't know about that.
And you just take the compliment, buddy.
Thank you.
But you do some good content on the Instagram page of the Cairo and Physio Clinic.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I'd certainly send some people over to that feed. So yeah, that's the Cairo and Physio Clinic. I'll put that in the bio, because you do produce some really good instructional videos. I've certainly, over the kind of lockdown period where we couldn't get in and see anyone, and I saw some of the videos you put out, and I thought, oh, that's a really good exercise, I'm going to try that. And then some of it's becoming more aware, and so yeah, I'd certainly put people onto those if they can't come and see you. But, you know, how are people able to get in touch with you, or if they're after some S&C training or rehabbing an injury? Like, where are you based and how can they get in touch?
I appreciate that. So we're the Cairo Physio Clinic. We're based in Pensby and Liverpool Speak. You can get in touch by just, you know, putting in the Cairo Physio Clinic into Google, or find us on Facebook or Instagram, booking an appointment. We're also based at UTS in Hoylake. So UTS is just a fantastic gym facility, amazing coaches there. We've got, you know, amazing staff. You know, their philosophy is, you know, very much get educated, get results, whether it's a class or a gym membership. You know, they sort of, you know, they really just take the time just to sort of try and educate people on good quality movement, good quality lifestyle. And it's just like a good community, do you know what I mean? So, you know, I'm based down there, where I take some patients down into the gym to do rehab work, and you know, just generally help them move better. And then they also have some fantastic FT coaches and trainers there. And also they do some, like I said, without going into too much detail, they do some fantastic work in the community. Foundation is it's fantastic. You know, the UTS have really set up a really good way of, you know, getting the community involved. You know, they also have people who've had, you know, mixed backgrounds, whether it's elderly or they have people who have, you know, been seriously ill in the past, you know, helping those get on their feet and, you know, have a better quality of life. So, you know, whether it's, you know, training at the gym, or whether it's, you know, getting in touch with the clinic, like I said, we're based in Penzing, we're all in Liverpool as well. You know, whether it's, you've seen someone like myself, seen a chiropractor initially, or whoever it may be, you know, it's one of those things. If you've had an injury that's been ongoing, you know, that's a request for change from your body. So I always think to get these things sorted is always the best idea. You know, whether it's not by me or it's by someone else, address it, you know. Sometimes it's an easy fix.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes a little bit of work.
Yeah, I think I'm the latter. anyway, that's absolutely awesome, and yeah, thanks so much, Jim, for joining me and coming on, and definitely check you out and the rest of the clinic. Highly recommend it.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's nice to speak to you again.
Yeah, good to see you, buddy, and hope to catch you soon.
Take care, bud.
Right, troops, some seriously good take home messages there. Seb was discussing with me actually one of Jem's mantras, which is teamwork makes the dream work, which really stood out for me as a focus point of their discussion. So by building up that network around you of support, it can really help you learn all you can about your own capabilities and hopefully make you stronger for the mountains and life in general. Jem is on the usual socials for Insta and Facebook, so get following him if you can, folks. He posts some really cool content, which will get your abs burning for sure and build some explosive power for the hills, hopefully. He's based down at the Chiron Physio Clinic based on the Wirral in Merseyside if you need to get in touch with him. And generally, that's a wrap on this episode, folks. Keep up to date with us on the usual socials. Subscribe if you want to at the Mountain Running Pod and drop us a message anytime with some feedback and banter. We have a few good episode planned for release soon where me and MC Bachelor will be back to rock the mic. Peace out, folks. Take care.